Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The 40-year-old Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion in America, was it a victory? Or was it the first shot in a 40-year war that's continued to this day over the meaning of life, the role of government in private women's lives and family decisions, and an ideological dividing line that has shaped American politics on many levels ever since that decision 40 years ago? Well, Time magazine writer Kate Pickard tracked the history of the movement right up to this very divisive year, where politicians put women's rights right back into the political conversation in America. It's a fascinating story on the cover of Time this week. Kate, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John.
40 years after Roe v. Wade, do you think that the abortion rights discussion is the same or fundamentally different from the women's rights discussion?
I think that's a great question. I think that particularly in the last year, when we heard all this talk of the war on women in the political discourse, you didn't hear a lot about sort of abortion rights specifically. There was a lot of talk of contraception, access to contraception, and equal pay. But I think that particularly folks on the pro-choice side of the issue don't talk a lot, frankly, about you know, sort of the reality of abortion access and some of those details that we explore in the story through some reporting that I did inside an actual abortion clinic in North Dakota.
In the case of North Dakota, given the realities of what it takes to get to the single abortion clinic in that state, is there for a large class of women no choice?
I think that that's indirectly, you know, the result of a lot of these state regulations that have made it harder for abortion clinics to stay open. And so they've been dwindling down. There are about 40% fewer providers of abortions now than there were in the early 1980s. Abortion is, of course, a federally protected right, but the ability to be able to afford and access the procedure may be impossible, especially in rural areas in America.
When did this strategy to make disincentives for people to actually get involved in the making abortions possible, clinics, the actual surgery. When did this strategy of disincentivizing those places to exist, when did that begin?
I mean, I think it was kind of a two-pronged strategy, and it's, you know, has its roots in the 1980s and 1990s when, you know, there were a lot of protests that kind of began against abortion doctors and some clinics, which really further stigmatized medical professionals that work in the abortion field and also intimidated a lot of folks out of that line of work. And, you know, additionally, in 1992, the Supreme Court issued a decision in which it said that abortion should remain legal. It upheld Roe, but said that states do have a right to regulate it. So that led to a huge spate of state regulations pushed by pro-life activists and pro-life state legislators to pass laws in the name of protecting the safety of women, but which have the indirect and, I would argue, intentional effect to decrease access to abortion.
So what kinds of regulations does the Supreme Court permit that actually work against women? And give as many examples in as many states as you can recall at this point.
So basically what Roe said is that abortion should be legal up to the point of viability, which is generally believed to be about, you know, between 20 and 22 weeks of pregnancy. But prior to that, states have a right to pass laws regulating abortion so long as these laws don't present what the court defined as an undue burden toward women, which means you can regulate abortion, but technically, states aren't supposed to make it impossible to access. Of course, that's a fuzzy line. One example of this is Mississippi, which has also only one abortion clinic and recently passed a law saying that doctors who work at the state's only abortion clinic must have hospital privileges. Of course, if a woman has complications during an abortion, which are extremely rare, the doctor who performed the abortion does not need admitting privileges in order for that woman to go to the hospital. So it's sort of unclear, you know, whether that particular law was needed. And in fact, the governor of Mississippi, Phil Bryant, did admit at one point that the law was an effort to end abortion in Mississippi. Some other regulations are things like, you know, that are perfectly legal are 24-hour waiting periods, parental consent and notification laws, mandatory ultrasound, mandatory counseling, and some limits on later-term abortions. But Gallup has done some really interesting public opinion surveys on this. And by and large, the American public supports many of the state regulations. I think, you know, most Americans believe abortion should be legal, but they think it should be restricted and limited and regulated. And as that conversation has really become sort of the, you know, the majority, I think the pro-choice movement hasn't really acknowledged that or, you know, tried to sort of get a seat at that particular table. They're still, you know, really in many ways pushing some of the messages they were pushing in the 1970s, even though a lot has changed.
If they were to take a seat at that table, what do you think would be the most powerful message for women of today from the pro-choice movement to address these growing, you suggest, encroachments, regulations against legal abortions?
It's a great question. I mean, I think it's very difficult territory for them. I think you may remember, you know, when Bill Clinton talked about abortion, he, you know, very memorably said it should be safe, legal, and rare. And that became part of the Democratic National Party platform. And actually, the rare was removed about 8 years ago. So now the platform says abortion should be safe and legal. But I think that that rare piece of it is really a way to kind of broaden the conversation for the pro-choice movement. And, you know, of course, the pro-choice movement does talk about contraception. They talk about it a lot. Talking about adoption is another thing that many have suggested, that they could do more of that to kind of connect with a public that's, you know, generally uncomfortable with the idea of abortion, even though it's more common than many people believe. But, you know, I think that most people, you know, would like to see fewer abortions. It's not something that, you know, anyone, I think, would consider an ideal circumstance.
Are young feminists in this fight, or do they feel as though the language of the pro-choice movement is something from the 70s and has no particular relevance to their lives in the 21st century?
I think that there's certainly a belief that young people on the pro-life side of the issue are more dedicated to the issue than young people who may believe that abortion should stay legal. There's definitely a feeling on the pro-choice establishment side that that young pro-choice Americans aren't willing to cast votes for state legislators, for instance, or members of Congress based solely on that issue. So that's one problem. Another issue is that a lot of the feminist legacy organizations like the National Organization for Women and Feminist Majority are headed up by women who are baby boomers or, you know, older than baby boomers, who were in their 20s and 30s when Roe was decided. And a lot of young feminist activists who are in their 20s and 30s now really want a piece of the pie and a piece of the power. And they feel as though they're not being kind of brought into those organizations. And in many ways, they're bypassing them. You know, the young activists that I talked to had some of the most interesting things to say on this topic. Many of them don't actually even use the term pro-choice. They talk about what they call reproductive justice, which is a term that came out of feminist women of color in the early 1990s. And reproductive justice is something broader, things like contraception, child care, health insurance coverage, economic opportunity. And so young activists really want a more holistic frame around this issue, which they think will have more resonance with the public, and particularly young people who are, you know, multi-issue voters frequently.
A political language perhaps more relevant going forward. Kate Pickert is a reporter for Time magazine who wrote this week's cover story on the 40th anniversary of the landmark Roe v. Wade decision by the U.S. Supreme Court legalizing abortion in the United States. Kate, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
So whatever you're talking about, thinking about as you head into the weekend, we want to know, how do you keep your optimism? Are you struggling to stay optimistic?
Ashley from Las Vegas. I think optimism can come automatically in many things if you will let it. Like in a sunrise or a nature walk with a young child, and especially in compassion for others. And most important, be grateful for the miracles in your own life.
Being optimistic in Las Vegas. Ashley, just that alone gets me through the weekend. A listener from Florida writes, things that occur in this world are often grim, but the world itself is not. It's filled with goodness if we're open enough to recognize it and appreciate it when we see it. Share your great stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That makes me optimistic. I'm John Hockenberry. See you on Monday. This is The Takeaway.